Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we review fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Many of us, who may be art historians, have an idea of the Silk Road, merchants who carried silk from China to as far away as ancient Rome in one of the first global trading networks. Historians now have since challenged that idea that there really was such an organized network, instead seeing it as a 19th century metaphor that obscures more than it explains. But Sin Wen, the author of The King's Road, Diplomacy and the Remaking of the Silk Road, tries to revive the idea that there really was a Silk Road, at least for the people of Dunhuang, what is now China's Gansu province. His book explains that there really were convoys traveling back and forth along an established route, though they likely saw themselves as diplomats more than merchants. He writes, quote, "People in Dunhuang, of course, did not exactly call the road that connected them with their neighbors the Silk Road. Nevertheless, had they been asked about it, they likely would have found the phrase entirely intelligible, even meaningful." Sin Wen is professor of East Asian Studies at Princeton University. His research interests in medieval China also include manuscript culture, urban history, and digital humanities. Today, Sin Wen and I talk about the Silk Road, the Dunhuang Archive, and the risks of orienting too much of the history of Central and East Asia around China. So, Sin, thanks for coming on the show today. Your book centers around Dunhuang, and I guess a body of documents that's called kind of the Dunhuang Archive. So I guess two questions to start. Where is Dunhuang, and what was this collection of documents?
First of all, thank you for the invitation. Dunhuang is in the province of Gansu, now in western China. It's at the western end of the west, the province of Gansu, bordering Xinjiang. So it's quite west in terms of the geography of China. The Dunhuang Archive, this is sort of my language. This basically refers to a small cave. Now, when you go to Dunhuang is very, famous for its mural paintings in this collection of stone of caves for Buddhist mural paintings called the Grotto of the Thousand Buddhas. There are many, many caves, and some of them are very large, and many of them have very beautiful, intricate mural paintings. But the Dunhuang Archive, collection that I call Dunhuang Documents, they are found, or they were found in the year 1900 in one of the smaller caves, maybe one of the smallest caves of the many hundreds of caves in this Buddhist complex. Generally, people call it the library cave because what is contained there were a huge collection. The numbers are, people don't agree on how many books or documents come from that cave, primarily because it's impossible to count. Because some of them are really big, and then some of them are just one piece of paper. But roughly, you can say that there are about 60,000 items or books or manuscripts that came from this cave. And this cave was sealed up around the first decade, or maybe the second decade of the 11th century, which means that everything that's sealed up in this library cave are from essentially before the year 1000. I call this collection of documents that I use from this cave, the Dunhuang Archive, because I'm mostly focusing on the secular documents. So this cave is primarily Buddhist. So 90% of the manuscripts are Buddhist. But there are these non-Buddhist texts that were collected by, you know, what we assume were Buddhist library keepers who used these texts or as papers to paste on the backside of the Buddhist manuscript to support them. In some other cases, they were probably kept for future use. So these sub-collection, this sub-collection of secular documents is what I call the Dunhuang Archive of Documents. And they were stored in the Dunhuang Library Cave, but their nature is somewhat different from the Buddhist manuscripts that were also kept in the cave.
So what's this part of the world like at this time? I mean, politically speaking, like what's the state of these different kingdoms and polities in this part of the world during this period of time you're studying?
Right. So I just mentioned that the cave was sealed up in around, you know, 1010, early 11th century. And this is a time when you think about the political history of eastern part of Eurasia, or, you know, this area that we call China now. This is the moment of really extreme political fragmentation that if you dial the clock back about, you know, two centuries, there were really only three major empires in this area: the Turco-Uyghur Empire in the north, the Tibetan Empire to the west, and then the Chinese Tang Empire in the east. And Dunhuang was located at the intersection of these three great powers. But around the middle towards the end of the ninth century, all three of these empires fell one after another. And what happened after the fall of these empires is that you began to have many, many independent, smaller independent kingdoms. In Chinese history, we call this period the era of the five dynasties and 10 kingdoms. There are too many to name, so we just give them a numerical title. But this is not only is the situation in China or in China proper, in the former Tang land. Because if you go further to the west, the area around Dunhuang, you see similar kinds of political fragmentation, that the oasis of Dunhuang was its own independent kingdom from 848 to the early 12th century. So for, you know, 100, almost 200 years, Dunhuang was an independent kingdom. And then there are other independent kingdoms around Dunhuang. There are four or five very important ones that I talk about in this book. So basically, politically speaking, this is an era of fragmentation of smaller kingdoms, at the same time, an absence of imperial power.
So your book is about the quote unquote Silk Road. And I know that's a term that has been, trying to think of the right word to use. I'm going to use the word deconstructed. I don't quite perhaps mean that, but it's a term that's been challenged, I think, by some recent history. How do we, and I mean kind of we as the general historians, think about the Silk Road? And then what is your book reacting to in that common view today?
Well, so this is a term that, first of all, this is a term that was invented by Ferdinand von Richthofen in 1877. Now, you know, the recent research that shows that in German academia, there people have been using this term before him, but he was really the first person to kind of give it a concrete meaning and use it to describe concrete historical phenomenon. So what he meant by this term was essentially that he was reading Greco-Roman sources and he was reading Chinese sources, I think translated Chinese sources, and then he was making connections about how and at what point did Chinese silk enter the Roman Empire. So this term for him describes the connection between essentially the Han Dynasty in China on the one hand, and then the Roman Empire in the Mediterranean world on the other hand, and the route that took silk to the West. So between him and us, there have been many research on this idea. This idea has been picked up by not just historians and scholars, but you know, musicians like Yo-Yo Ma, and I think there was a dark web website called the Silk Road. Right, this is sort of a very ingenious kind of concept that use a fairly romantic reference, and then try to use it to describe an actual historical phenomenon. So more recently, scholars, like you said, have been casting, well, I would say there are, roughly speaking, you can maybe say that there are two groups of scholars, if we divide them according to their attitude towards this term. There are people who continue to embrace the term. And very often this term is used for scholars who are interested in global history, right? This is a way for us to look beyond the national units that so often determine how we tell our history and look at the transnational and transregional connections that we know were always there. But for another group of scholars who, I guess, work more closely on the area of Central Eurasia, there has been some doubts. There are doubts about whether we should continue to use this term. First of all, because it has this colonial legacy from the 19th century, and people have obviously found that silk was by no means the only, or at times not even the most important goods that were transmitted between Eastern and the Western end of the Eurasian continent. There are many other things. And then, often you don't really see a clear road either. Often you see shifting path or a collection of networks. So, with the growth of our knowledge, this term seems less and less sort of applicable to the historical primary source that we discovered. But I sort of make this argument, and this is not something that I set out to do when I wrote this book. Obviously, it's good to talk about this phenomenon that people are interested in. But when I started the research of this book, which is essentially consists of reading all the secular documents that were stored in the Dunhuang Cave, I just wanted to test if this is a idea that is valid on the basis of the primary sources. What I found, somewhat to my surprise, was that, in fact, this is actually a pretty good term. If you have to come up with a term to describe what you find in the Dunhuang documents. So what my method was essentially that I collected the examples that I can find of long-distance travelers, and that just means people who have traveled hundreds of kilometers, sometimes over a thousand, even thousands of kilometers. I collect cases of long distance travel that involve both people and things. So I collect examples of human travelers and non-human travelers. And I kind of, the book is essentially an attempt at reconstructing their life on the road. The two things that I've found that really kind of convinced me that this is a term that's worth using is first that silk was really important. Silk was everywhere. Everyone was traveling with silk. But most importantly, silk was also both a gift that that these travelers exchanged and used to kind of facilitate their relationship with their hosts. It is also a commodity that were used locally in Dunhuang to buy and sell other things. So in this sense, and here I should add a note that by silk, I also when I talk about silk, I also kind of include other precious textiles like cotton cloth and other types of cloth. So these sort of textiles were the most versatile of the goods that were that traveled with the with these travelers. So that's number one. The second discovery was that the idea of the road was actually also very central to the life of these travelers. They talk about the road all the time. They pray for safety on the road. They describe the road in their writings. And they're in many places on the long route from Central Asia to China. We know that there were roads. So the idea of a road was also not very problematic to me. So once I found, once I sort of dug into the primary sources a little bit more, it became more and more clear to me that the idea of the Silk Road was actually a pretty valid concept that we should continue to embrace and obviously define, right, with precision in the context of a particular work and try to explore. But fundamentally, I think these two elements were central to how people communicated long distance in the medieval time.
All right. So, so let's talk about some of the people that traveled the Silk Road. I think in the popular conception and the way it's normally slotted into global histories, the Silk Road is seen as a trade network. These are merchants traveling back and forth. But you focus much more on diplomats, on envoys. So I guess what were the kinds of people, the kinds of groups that actually made these journeys on the Silk Road?
Right. So this is, I guess this is another, maybe you can call it discovery of this book. I really started out, this was my dissertation that I defended in 2017. So I started research for this project around, 10 years ago, 2012, 2013. I really wanted to write a history about long distance traveling merchants. I was very inspired by Etienne de la Vessière's books, his book on the Sogdian traders. I wanted to write a book about Dunhuang traders, traders that travel long distance, whose life we can reconstruct from Dunhuang documents. But I couldn't find any. The entirety of the Dunhuang corpus, I might have missed something, but I went through most of the secular documents. And I could only really find two, three, maybe cases of where people actually traveled for business. They talk about it in that way, right? They went somewhere to buy things, travel long distance to do that, that are documented in the Dunhuang documents. But in the process, I discovered another group. And this sort of this thing just sort of comes at you, continues to come at you, once you open these volumes of secular documents, that the overwhelming majority of travelers, that long-distance travelers that we can find in the Dunhuang documents, were traveling for diplomatic purposes. There are, you know, a substantial number of Buddhist travelers, and these groups also overlap. Some Buddhists would travel on behalf of their home state as a diplomat while maintaining their status as a Buddhist. There are also Buddhists who travel for purely religious reasons, right? They just want to go to India for pilgrimage. So there's some overlap. But overwhelmingly, the ones that you discover are diplomatic travelers. And they're really, they can be almost anything that you encounter in these documents. There's some cases of really poor people, slaves even, who traveled, who at least wanted to travel as diplomats in order to change their fate, to improve their economic status. There are, you know, unsurprisingly, officials, many officials who traveled as diplomats. But you also see a lot of kings, the king of Dunhuang, or the princes, queens, these people who stood at the top echelon of the Dunhuang and certain neighboring societies. They often traveled themselves as diplomatic travelers to their neighboring states. And then, you know, this is sort of the group of people, right? And we also see a few examples of actually female travelers traveling as diplomats. But in addition to these people, there are also another group of non-human travelers, like elephants, monkeys, horses and camels, and then, you know, more inanimate things like jade, silk, books, food, water, equipment to cook food in, anything you can think of, really, for this particular period of time. You can almost find all of these, you can find all of these people and things travel together on diplomatic missions around Dunhuang.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So what might someone traveling on the Silk Road, what might they have seen? I remember in one part of your book, you talk about there actually were kind of, like, there were checkpoints, there were stations, there was kind of infrastructure kind of along this road. It wasn't just a dusty trail in the desert, I guess. How built up was the Silk Road, I guess?
Right. So this is something that I talk in particular in chapter 4. What I found in writing that chapter, and especially relying on a itinerary of a group of Dunhuang diplomats as they travel through the southern part of Mongolia, was that they have a pretty clear sense that the kind of places that they were traveling through. And they were traveling through different kinds of places. It's definitely not all paved, you know, highways. There's I guess that that's a fantasy, right? But it's also not all deserts and, you know, stretching long stretches of sands that that makes it very difficult to travel. That's the impression that we get from some earlier travelers. That in this in the Dunhuang documents, what you find is that there are a number of different types of stops that one can stop at. There are these postal stops that were built by the large empires such as the Tang and the Song, that once you get within the domain of these states, you're basically very well taken care of. There are postal inns that you can stay in. There are people who can escort you from one place to another that you don't even need to understand the geography anymore. So that's one kind, right? You have the postal road. And then, but these states, the border of these states don't end where the postal road stops. They also extend further back into the you know, beyond their frontiers. And often there were military establishments that were not connected with or to the network of postal roads that, but that were nonetheless still considered part of these states. And the travelers often would stay in these military establishments as well. And you could sort of imagine that the roads between the military establishment and the official postal roads were probably not as good as the postal roads themselves, but were probably also not merely just unmarked and untended sort of mass of land. So that's the second type. And then you also see them describing themselves stopping at places that I call natural stops. These are places where there are water. You know, water sources are important for any traveler. So when there isn't a military or a governmental establishment, they simply stop in places where there are water. And between these, you know, areas with water sources, you can sort of, what I imagine, right, this is not very well recorded. What I imagine this will be like when we go hiking now, there are markers left by earlier travelers, and there are probably a footpath that you can detect on the road, but maybe there isn't very well maintained road in this area. And then the last type is what you mentioned. This is sort of the common image that we often associate with the Silk Road, which is the desert. Deserts do and did exist, particularly to the west of Dunhuang. And these deserts are, excuse me, these deserts, I guess what I found from the documents that really surprised me was that they talk about these deserts. They talk about parts of the desert where you have to carry water to travel because there is no water source. But traveling in deserts themselves, itself, this action itself was apparently quite routine. It was not as difficult as we think. And in fact, I calculated the speed on the basis of a few documents, and it seems that traveling the desert didn't even slow these travelers down. Which I guess in some ways makes sense, right? If you're in a desert, you just want to get out as quickly as possible. But there must have been also markers in the desert that help people orient themselves. Earlier sources tell us that, you know, people who travel in the deserts use bones of dead people and animals as marker. That might have been the case. I think there must have been less gruesome markers for our travelers too.
So kind of, I believe near the end of your book, you kind of come to the conclusion that diplomacy, you know, quote unquote, was critical to the people living in Dunhuang. I guess, critical to their economy, critical to their society. I guess, what was it, like, why was diplomacy so important to this community?
Well, so this question, I guess to answer this question, I have to first establish that diplomacy was important to these people. This was a process. I did not realize this. I sort of went into this project. Well, like I said, first I wanted to write about the merchants, and then I realized I can't write about them because they didn't really exist. Then I switched to writing about the diplomats. But my assumption was that they were essentially only important for policymakers, for people who wanted to have good relations with their neighbors. They sent a diplomat to their neighboring state, and then they negotiated their relationship. But the more I read, the more I kind of began to doubt that picture. I'll give you a few examples, right? There are all these contracts that were made in Dunhuang, when people have an economic transaction, they create a contract to make sure that both parties would stick to the terms after the transaction was concluded. And among the contracts found in Dunhuang, there are about 40%, and this is a random selection of economic documents, right? It deals with every aspect of the life of people in Dunhuang. You know, you buy a house, you use a contract, you buy a slave, you use a contract, you hire someone to work for you, you use a contract. But of all these contracts, about 35 to 40% of all these contracts are about diplomatic travelers. In fact, they're specifically made when people have to borrow something in order to fund their diplomatic journey. So this really kind of stopped me on my tracks a bit once I realized this. Because, you know, when we think about modern economy in any state that we live in, diplomacy itself, right? Not the things that diplomacy accomplishes, but the functioning of diplomacy itself is never really a huge part of the economy. So once I realized that, I began looking in other aspects of the life of Dunhuang and other similar OEC states. I found, and this is a document that only exists in a neighboring state. I haven't found anything similar to similar in Dunhuang, but I think it sort of shows, illustrates this point really well. And this is a document that I also talk about in the book that were discovered in a neighboring OEC state, also independent state in Turfan, in the late 5th century. That essentially lists all the people that the Turfan government sent out to help escort foreign diplomats who travel through Turfan. So this is a service industry, right? You have people who help escorts who come in and then just travel with them outside of your state. Within the space of 1 year in that document tells us that there were about 1,400 people, presumably all men, who worked in this particular role. So now the population of Turfan at that time, we know. So this means that about 15 to 20% of all male adults were engaged in this very specific act of escorting foreign envoys. So these are just two examples. I have many other examples to show that diplomacy was really a central industry, if you can use that word, to these small oasis kingdoms on the Silk Road, like Dunhuang, like Turfan. And the reason is pretty, you know, simple in a way, right? These are small states. They need to maintain their own legitimacy. So having connection with their neighbors is very important to them. And this is the source of their, very often, their source of their political legitimacy. And so these kings were very keen on sending people out to their neighboring states. And these diplomats, in the process, also gained profit by, you know, exchanging gifts, by sometimes doing business on the side, that they also have something to gain. So to people like Dong Huang, what I discovered, what I think, you know, I'm trying to show in this book is that diplomacy was not just a specialized branch of the government. It is a central institution in the society that many more people than what we're used to in our time were engaged in diplomacy. They're engaging diplomacy in different ways, but their life, diplomacy was implicated in their life in the economic sense, in the political sense, even ideologically, right? In a lot of the prayers, these Dong Huang people, even commoners, but also, you know, kings and officials, they will pray for the smooth functioning of diplomacy. So diplomacy was really a central institution in the life of the people who lived in these medieval oases.
So I think I have one more question, and this gets to something you talk about in the conclusion to your book. You know, I was struck by an observation that you make in your conclusion, which is that China, you know, being such a large country, such a long-lasting civilization, tends to warp the history of areas around it. You know, in much the same way that history in Western Europe tends to do. Because we always complain about Eurocentrism, for example, which you avoid. You try to avoid doing that in your book. You call it Eastern Eurasia. You know, what do we gain by looking at these regions kind of on their own terms, as opposed to as part of some grand Chinese history?
Well, so I think what we gain in this particular case, which, you know, this book, you can almost, I was in one of the versions of the introduction, I call it a micro history. I think it really is a micro history of Dong Huang. And you know, it's neighboring states, but it's really a history that's focused on this particular place. It's a very small place. The benefit of doing so is that you begin to see that a lot of the things that you assume you know by studying Chinese history in the grand and kind of in the traditional kind of way began to collapse. For instance, I think the best example to show this is to look at the system that is used to describe Chinese world order, right? The tributary system. When we think of history of diplomacy in China, that's often the first thing that comes to mind. That's how you know a lot of Chinese emperors. Imagine that they organize, or they want to imagine that that's how their diplomatic world was organized by you know these foreigners, these second, third tier countries coming to China to give tribute. But if you look at the case in Dong Huang, and especially Dong Huang's dealings with areas that's further to the west, you see that the language and the assumptions of the tributary system cannot really hold. I'll just give you one example. In the 1970s, when the neighbor of Dong Huang, Khotan, scored a huge victory over the Kalahanids further to the west, the king of Dong Huang wrote to wrote to the king of Khotan. And in the letter, which is written in Chinese, he compared the king of Khotan to the founder of the Han dynasty, Liu Bang, Han dynasty in China, that is. And he called himself an official or a servant to the king of Khotan, whom he called Huang Di, emperor. And the king of Khotan himself called himself actually in Khotanese, King of Kings of China. And in Chinese, in the Chinese documents produced by the Khotanese kings, they called themselves the great Han son of heaven of Khotan, Da Yu Tian Han Tianzi. So when you look at these examples, you realize that the assumptions of the tributary system, which is central to how we understand China's foreign relations, really stopped working here. Not only did it stop working, it was turned on its head that now a Khotanese, you know, which is a Iranian-speaking person, is sitting on top, and the King of Dunhuang, which primarily is a Chinese-speaking state, was paying tribute to this non-Chinese king. So this is, you know, one of the many ways that I think, you know, focusing on something else, something that's not traditionally covered in Chinese history, at least in this period, can change how we understand a lot of the basic assumptions that we have about Chinese history. But the last, but there's one more point that I want to make, which is, I'm also not trying to, and this is sort of why I decided not to call it a microhistory. I don't want to write a book that is not about China either. I think what this book is trying to do is to redefine what we mean by Chinese history, because once we get into the Song Dynasty, so this is, you know, starting by the year 960, when we talk about Chinese history, we essentially talk about the area that's covered by the domain of the Song. So all the places that used to be part of the Tang no longer were a part of Chinese history anymore. So one of the things that I try to show in this book is that connections did not disappear by any means, that there were a lot of people traveling back and forth. What's happening in the Song were having profound impact on what went on in Dunhuang and in Khotan and all these other states that we should understand. You know, this is sort of a greater version of Chinese history, redefining Chinese history as Eurasian history, that we should look at all these different places in the context of the fall of the Tang Dynasty and connect their stories into a new history of China.
Well, I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Xin Wen, author of The King's Road, Diplomacy and the Remaking of the Silk Road. Xin, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? And what's next for you? What might the next project be?
So the book is available everywhere that you get books, right? So it's not hard to find. It's the King's Road. You can find anywhere all the usual suspects. What is next? I have been working on this totally unrelated, or maybe not totally unrelated, given my answer to the last question. This new project, which is a urban history of the city of Chang'an, that was the capital of the Tang Dynasty. So in this project, I'm also interested in what happened after the fall of the Tang Dynasty. But in the new project, I'm focusing more on the city of the capital city of Chang'an, which, you know, was the largest city in the medieval world, 1 million people, you know, larger than the island of Manhattan, and how it shrank in the space of 1 to 2 years to about 1/16, 1/17 its original size, and stay that way for 500 years, and people just lived in the ruins of this big big imperial capital. So I want to explore the history of how people did that, and what happened to this huge ruin, and what the implications of this is to our understanding of Chinese history. So this is what I'm working on now. Hopefully, you know, there will be something for the readers to see soon in a few years.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's NickRigordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia, that's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We hope you subscribe to the Asian Review Books podcast now on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for more news and who's coming up on the show. But before then, thank you, Sin, for joining me today.
Thank you very much.